I don't mind other guys dancing with my girl. That's fine, I know them all pretty well. But I know sometimes I must get out.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 17. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two new comics from November 13th, 2013. Little Gotham number 8 and Rocket Girl number 2. As well as Bandette, volume 1, Presto. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch this week, we have living legend, artist, and writer, Howard Chaykin. Just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there's a chance of spoilers from here in on out.
Hello, I'm Elijah. My favorite superhero is Batman.
Hi, I'm Lizzie, and my favorite superhero is Wonder Woman.
Hi, Jay, it's Thor.
Thor?
Yeah.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. I mean, Aaron doesn't even listen to me most of the time. Right, Aaron?
What?
Exactly. Huh? The theme of the show this week is adolescence in turmoil. Young protagonists in traditionally adult situations can make for some interesting conflict, and so can familiar characters watered down for younger readers.
Oh, is it my turn now?
Yeah, asshole.
Okay. Well, in between comic segments, at least for this week, your very own nerd confessions and nerd stories, we want to celebrate the little geeky things we all say, do, read, and enjoy. Share them with us, and we'll share them in an upcoming episode of the show. But you got to share them if you want to hear them, so let us know if you want us to continue featuring listeners on the show this way. Better yet, call in your stories. You can call, Skype, or email. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
It should be noted that in the script, there was definitely another word in there that you chose to edit out, but that's fine. I can be the one who swears, and you can be the good one.
I keep it clean.
Yeah. In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers, and of course the show account at Comics Therapy. One other thing to draw your attention to is also on our website, comicstherapy.com, the first annual Comics Therapy Secret Menorah Gift Exchange. Can you hear in my voice how excited I am about this? You have until November 22nd. That's next Friday to register. On the following day, through the magic of the internet, everybody participating will be paired anonymously with a partner. Some people have already made wish lists, other people are leaving snarky comments on Twitter, but really, this should just be a blast, a fun way to share in the spirit of the season with your fellow comics fans. The more the merrier, everyone is welcome. You don't need an invitation other than me saying, hey, join us. I'm even allowing Aaron to participate. Speaking of which, I kind of feel like I haven't talked to you in a while. So how was your week?
You haven't talked to me in a while?
Yeah, for real. Like, we talked all morning. But before that, I feel oddly detached from you.
That's because you worked 2 days this week.
I know.
Those of us who have to work full time or more than full time don't notice these things.
You're such a dick. I work more than 2 days. It's just that I had 2 days of like hella work and not work from home. So it was an unusual week for me in that respect.
Well, do you want to talk about your week first?
Well, I was just giving you the chance to share whatever fun and exciting thing you have going on.
For me, it was just a regular week of comic books and working and family and dogs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so nothing really that exciting.
I mean, you know, nothing crazy to report. Status quo.
So, AI. Is the implication that what I have to share is crazy?
I think it's a bigger, more exciting week for you than it normally is.
Yeah, I got on a plane and I flew down to LA and then I worked a fuckload and then I got up and did it. Well, there was some drinking in between because that's how we roll. And then I got
shocking.
Up. Right. got up the next morning and did it all again and hopped back on a plane and flew back up here.
Okay, but seriously, I don't know what people pay you for. What is it?
I know. It's fascinating to me that you have no idea. It's like you don't pay attention at all. And at this point, because I signed a non-disclosure agreement, I can't tell you. I'd have to kill you. Or I would be killed. And
you can't really talk generally what you do?
I'm a scenic designer. And so that means...
Like when you're walking on like a downtown area or something like that, like the flags that hang or the potted plants?
No. Oh my goodness. Wow. You have no culture, no appreciation for entertainment.
I like a good shopping district.
Scenic designer, implying like the entertainment industry, theater and television and movies and on-site installations and museums and things like that.
Right. So like those adult movies that we watch, like when they're, I don't know, at a, you know.
See, you're the one who brought up porn, and now you're going to have to fight your way out of this without making it sound like all you do is sit around watching porn. Oh, I work on computers. Yeah.
Yeah, that's code. That's code for sitting around watching porn all day.
Well, let me just set the record straight officially right here. I don't do porn. I never have. I never will. Thanks for that rumor, Aaron. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Yep. So,
well, do you want to move on, or do you want to tell me more about things you can't talk about?
No, it's good. It's like three huge new projects that I was invited to be a part of. So,
is one of them Avengers 2?
No, there's only one of them. Only one of them is a film, and it's small.
Adult?
No, not at all. It's a documentary.
Well, who else would watch that? Kids aren't watching that.
Okay, I guess in that regard. It is adult.
You are working on an adult film.
Right. But, like, if we call it that, it's going to make it sound really different from what it actually is.
I don't know what you and your friends talk about.
we're just going to leave that one out there.
All right.
Let's talk about you. What book do you want to talk about this week for 90 seconds?
Are we ready?
I'm ready. I've got everything right here.
Okay. You're supposed to count me into this.
Okay. Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week that we are not analyzing. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you going to talk about a comic?
Yes.
Okay, go.
I'm talking this week about The Death of Superman from 1992 or 3. Now I forget. But I pulled that out of the long box this week, and I was reading it with Luke, and it just is, I'm getting tongue-tied, because I'm so emotional about this.
Okay.
But it just brought up a lot of talk, because it's such a quintessential, it was such a, like, an ingrained comic book from my youth.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I think kind of everyone does that's our age.
Sure.
That was reading comics.
And how many copies do you have?
I've got, like, two copies of most of the issues, and then like two copies of the trade too, because they're gonna be worth money someday. You got it, they're investment purposes. I remember that vividly from that time too, like how collectors were like snatching up, and that's why they sold so many copies of it. It was really one of those big push of like, buy five or six copies because you're gonna sell this, you know, for $1 million and
push your kids through college. Yeah,
right.
I have two copies. Absolutely. I have one still wrapped, and I have one that I read, and...
There you go. Everyone does.
Yep.
Yep. So we're all going to be rich. Congratulations. Yeah.
Well, so what did Luke think?
I mean, dude, fine. We just kind of looked at... I just looked at the pages with him, you know, and he pointed to Superman and asked who Doomsday was, and, you know, just go over the characters and that sort of thing. But it doesn't mean the same thing to him that it does to me.
You're out of time. What does it mean to him, and what does it mean to you?
I mean, it's just pictures to look at when you're three.
Right. And then for you?
That was The Death of Superman. That was a big deal. That was like, for me, it was like, oh my God, they really killed Superman. Like, you didn't know. You just didn't know at that time. Like, oh, Superman will be back in a year, and there's going to be a million now Superman books that they can sell 10, you know, 10 times more than they have been. And then Superman will be back.
Right.
I mean, it was the other one we were looking at. I mean, we're kind of going off a tangent, but it was...
We always do.
Yeah, it was the Nightfall series, you know, when Batman gets his back broken by Bane.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great. I mean, that's another great series. Like, those two series, or events, whatever you want to call them, were, like, my favorites as a kid. Like, those just blew my mind that they could do something like this in comics, and it could happen, and, you know, it's just like, the Dark Knight falls and Azrael takes over and becomes Batman. You know, like, that's the first time it wasn't Bruce Wayne.
Hmm.
And Bane was a scary character, and all, like, the villains escaped from Arkham, and he had to fight them, and he was fighting through them, you know, and so exhausted by the end that Bane just breaks him.
So, some of that, well, I would say all of that is kind of gone now. I mean, that's been the thing that I respond to every time we talk about some of these solo titles, like Thor and Iron Man, especially when the stakes are presented as being so high, and yet we all know that they're not.
Right.
So it's interesting to hear you mention that, the impact that it had when you were a kid, actually believing that, actually buying into the death of Superman as literally like the death of Superman. So
yeah. I mean, who, you didn't know, and it's not like my parents read comic books and could say, like, oh, you know, Superman dies all the time. You know, it was on the news. It was a big deal.
Right.
And,
you know, look how far we've come.
Well, it still happens. Death of, you know, death of Spider-Man.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, even though we know better, we know Peter Parker will be back, it's still still a good story.
Right.
And I think in a way, it's forced writers to maybe write better events, like when they do decide to kill characters like this.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm willing to say that's, I guess I don't have enough data to, I guess, compare the events from before the early 90s and after, but.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll allow you, as long as we can move on to talk about our first book now.
Fine, let's just do it. We got a lot of show to get through, because we got a big interview at the end.
We do. It's a super exciting interview.
This is Tom Burnett, otherwise known as TPhoto10 on Twitter, and I'm calling in with my son, Noah.
Hi. I like Thor because in the movie, he learned a good lesson, and my favorite comic is Nova. I like the artwork and the helmet.
Okay, so our first book this week is Lil Gotham number 8. This is the print version of the digital first comic by the same name. So it's number 16, 17, and 18. Lil Gotham is written by Dustin Nguyen and Derek Friedolf. And Dustin also does the art, which is stunning. Saida Temafonte does the lettering, and it's published by DC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, can you help us understand what the hell this, like, Lil series is?
It's hard to explain as, like, a purpose, because there's not really a purpose. It's out of continuity.
Yeah.
They're fun stories that are, it is all ages, but it's just not tied to having to adhere to any kind of New 52 kind of stuff.
Yep.
But it's all homage to it as well.
Yeah.
The art style and writing style lend itself to be able to be accessible to anyone.
Yeah.
But I think if you have an understanding of the DC universe, there's a lot more, there's a second level of appreciation.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that, and I, just in case anybody doesn't know, I'm like a complete DC novice. My understanding and appreciation is very limited. Not because I'm a jerk about it, but I'm just sort of slower in being familiar with those stories because I didn't grow up with them like I did with Marvel. So that being said, this is very approachable. Avi reads it. It's, like I mentioned, it's visually very appealing and very stimulating. But part of the attraction is that it's not, there is no, like, homework requirement to get into this. So I think it's a kind of an interesting take on the premise or the purpose. I don't mean to get, like, too esoteric here with, like, what is the goal of this comic book? But it is a nice, refreshing change from something that has been, for me personally, like, a little bit overwhelming to kind of get into some of what's going on with the newer New 52 stories.
Oh, for sure. This has nothing really to do with anything going on with that, but it's still familiar enough. Like, you don't have to be immersed in the DC universe to, you still know enough. Mm-hmm. You know who the characters are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's really the only kind of, like, barrier to entry to really get, you know, I don't know, full feeling for it. But regardless, this is fun for kids. It's not quite so much like a Tiny Titans kind of thing.
Right.
Like, it doesn't really work for Luke at 3, but I think it's a good, you know, it's a good one for Avi at, you know, 7.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at 8. Or 7, 8, yeah. So it's nice that it fills that niche. And Luke still likes the way it looks.
Yeah.
And then I like reading it, so It's kind of nice that way, but it's a nice look at what, you know, what we call all ages. Is not really all ages. I think there are stages of all ages.
Yeah. And we've talked about that before because it's such a ridiculous cop-out of a term. But I do almost wish that we were more proactive in categorizing all ages. And mm-hmm. because there's content and there's also sophistication of story. And I'm making a distinction between the two. And one of them has to do with what's appropriate. And the other one has to do with the ability to just kind of jump right in and not necessarily have a knowledge base.
Yeah. And well, let's talk about some of these stories. So
okay.
Most of them are themed around the time of year.
Yeah.
You know, so whether it's holidays or just seasonal.
Seasonal, right. On vacation.
on vacation, right, or it's Christmas time, or right. It's Valentine's Day, or something like that. So it's taking these characters, or I really like the Thanksgiving one.
Yeah.
With the turkeys and everything else. So, but they're parables as well, you know, about love or about friendship, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like the Aesop fables of the DC universe.
That's a nice analogy.
Yeah, I mean, in a way. Not all of them, but a lot of them strive to be that way.
Sure, because they stand on their own, and so they have that kind of moral wrap-up at the end,
mm-hmm.
which is a very, almost like, serial cartoon-like strategy for presenting a story to younger kids.
Yeah, so there's not much else in Big Two comics that do that.
Oh, absolutely not. And that's part of how long has this been my soapbox? It's just a total lack of that kind of story being produced by the two publishers that are marketing their characters to kids so heavily, and yet there's like nothing for those kids to read. So I do appreciate this, and I do wish that there were other options out there. I really, really wish that there was more creator-owned stuff that was accessible for younger readers also. And I think that those stories in this series that Avi likes are not the ones with the adult characters. He likes the ones with the kids, which is understandable because they're relatable. And there's something very classic about having a younger superhero character kind of go through what would be traditionally like adult behaviors and yet do so in an appropriate way, like something for an 8-year-old or a little bit older to read.
Well, yeah, because it's, you can either have a coming-of-age story from the perspective of a child, or you can have a story that a child can relate to using adult characters as a bridge to that adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what this does pretty well, too.
Yeah, but not without, it's never heavy-handed. And so right. I think, I know we don't talk about it from a separation of writing and art very frequently, but in this particular case, I think that the lightness of the tone and the lightness aesthetically are very, and it has to do with, you know, the same person being involved with both, right? It's so much a part of why it's a successful packaging of that kind of story. It doesn't feel like work. It feels like really accessible. We keep saying that, but it's true. I do wish that there was more like that. I've been, just because when we set the theme for this week, I've been thinking so much, and I often do, but I've been thinking so much about what I read when I was a kid at the late 80s and the early 90s, and what I want my kid to read. And I keep going back to older things more and more because I don't know. There's a lack of that available now, and it just seems crazy to me because there are so many awesome comics being produced right now. But for whatever reason, there's still a limit to what we're willing to do to encourage a new generation of comics readers and a new younger audience.
I agree, and I'm sure this is the last time you will talk about it, or us.
yeah, well, you can tell me to shut up at any moment. I know that you've already tuned me out. It's fine. We can talk about Rocket Girl now.
Okay, let's go back to the future.
Okay.
Okay, recording now. Who's your favorite superhero?
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman?
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about Wonder Woman?
Mommy's naked at Halloween.
Yeah, she does like that with her bracers, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Who's that right there?
I know.
Who's that?
Thor.
Who's that?
I know.
Who is that?
I know.
Who is that? You know who that is.
I know.
Iron Man. Who's that?
Hulk.
What does Hulk sound like? Does Daddy sound like Hulk?
Yes.
Yes, all right. What PJs are you wearing right now?
Supergirl.
Yes. Do you like Supergirl?
Yes.
Yes. Wonder Woman still your favorite superhero?
Yes.
Yes, all right. Thank you.
Next up, Rocket Girl number 2, written by Brandon Montclair and drawn by Amy Reeder. Rocket Girl is published by Image Comics.
Okay, so this is directly from Image. A teenage cop from a high-tech future is sent back in time to 1986, New York City. Dayoung Johansson is investigating the Quantum Mechanics mega corporation for crimes against time. As she pieces together the clues, she discovers the future she calls home, an alternate reality version of 2013, should not exist at all.
Yay!
How do you feel about this book, Aaron?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It's, man, talk about an awesome teenage protagonist.
Yes. I also loved that in the second issue, like one of the lines, I'd have to find it exactly, but it's the teenage cops exist because adults can't be trusted.
Yeah, it's sort of lovely right there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Given how I generally feel about teenagers, especially.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. There's a lot of humor in this book, but I also just like it conceptually. Like, I'm a sucker for anything time travel related.
Sure. I love science fiction pretty much more than anything else. So I absolutely agree. I think that there's a danger here in it being too much about the time travel as the pieces start to unravel, because the whole premise is that she shouldn't need to exist. Like, something went wrong and the alternate future was created. And so I'm sort of hoping that, like, we don't lose her in the process, but I'm sure that, like, the book is called Rocket Girl. I'm sure that there's a plan for keeping her around.
Yeah, but the fun thing is you really have no limits on where you could go with it.
Yeah.
It's when you set, like, I like, when it comes to science fiction, I like as long as a writer sets the boundaries of the whatever universe they're creating as wide enough, then, you know, your possibilities are pretty endless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, though, in the first issue especially, I didn't love her, and maybe a little bit in the second issue too. I mean, she's so cocky, but she's so, I don't know. I think I wanted her to be more clever, to have a little bit more gumption to back up her cockiness, and yet that's sort of the whole thing about teenagers.
Right. If you have ever met a 15-year-old girl, that is pretty darn accurate.
Right. God, they're so annoying. But she's adorable, so you look past it.
Yeah, that's truth in character creation.
Mm-hmm.
That you wouldn't have a 15-year-old cop who has all the, you know, her wits about her, forethought, and, you know, all that. No, it's like they know everything. They're going to go head first into it because they don't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just go along, and you make your mistakes, and then you learn from them, and then suddenly you're 35 with two kids and a mortgage, and, you know.
I must have skipped that part, because everything up until the turn 35 is still an accurate description of the way that I approach the world.
Time travel.
Right. Time travel, except for that part. I'm glad that you kind of called me on that one, because I was annoyed by her characterization, but that is so telling, because that's who she is. That's what teenagers are. And in that respect, it actually makes her a little bit more endearing.
Yeah.
She is not infallible, even though she is from the future. And she is super reckless, which we've talked about in other characters can be like a tremendous asset to put in your back pocket as a creator. If your character is a little bit headstrong and yet has really good motivation and like really wants to be a good person, that's often the recipe for good comics.
Yep. Plus a rocket pack doesn't hurt either.
Oh, no kidding. And so pretty.
Yep. We don't need to talk. We don't need to go into details, but Amy Reeder's art is pretty. I mean, that seals the deal on the book.
Yeah. It's so unfair because it's only the second issue, but I think we both kickstarted this, right?
No, I missed the Kickstarter on it.
What?
I know.
Oh wow. Okay.
Look, I can't catch them all, Pokemon Master.
I don't understand Pokemon, but I do understand that I actually got this before you did.
I gotta let you have wins every once in a while, otherwise you're just a nightmare to talk to.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, this is one of them. So, for the record, I am the winner. But
congratulations.
But it is very early in this story, and it's the second issue, and I just wanted to put it out there just because it is really rare to have a young character kind of captured accurately like that, with the positives and the negatives, and yet still tell the story successfully. So, hooray.
Yep.
Speaking of which, we got one more.
Yeah, I say hooray to this as well.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Let's talk about it.
My name is Chloe. I'm 5 years old. And from Michigan, my favorite comic book character is Pinkie Pie. Bye-bye.
Finally, this week brings us the Bandette Volume 1 hardcover from Dark Horse Comics, collecting the first 5 issues of Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover's Eisner Award-winning series, published originally digitally by Monkey Brain Comics.
Okay, so from the Dark Horse site, a costumed teen burglar by the nom de art of Bandette and her group of street urchins find equal fun in both skirting and aiding the law in Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover's enchanting Eisner-nominated series. But it won! It won for Best Digital Series.
Yeah.
Okay. But can even Bandette laugh off the discovery of a criminal plot against her life? Collects issues 1-5 of the acclaimed Monkey Brain Digital Series, plus tons of extras. And here is the caveat, which is that Aaron and I have both purchased this in hardcover, and neither of us have seen the beautiful, like, physical copy yet. I really just wanted to talk about this book. We haven't yet, and I think it's fantastic. So I've read them all digitally, so has Aaron. I've ordered it in hardcover, so has Aaron. All of you should do both as well. But let's talk about how kind of delightful Bandette is as a character.
Yeah, well, this goes back, I think, to all the books we've talked about this week. And it's that line of story and whimsy and fun, but still having a story that is engaging. You know, it's like, this kind of has made me think a lot of where is the line drawn between just like cartooning and storytelling, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if storytelling is quite the right comparison word to use, but it's, you definitely can have silly strip comics, and then you can have regular comics, but it's that gray area in between. That's a really hard line to stay in between and to do it well. But I think when it's done well like this, you have something that is award winning. It seems like that happens often enough. You know, it's when somebody gets it right, when a team gets it right, it's really right. It really either goes either way.
Well, it's really easy to celebrate something that hits that sweet spot, probably because it doesn't happen as often as we wish that it would.
Yeah.
There's a lightness to the story, and yet I don't feel like I'm reading a kid's book when I read this.
Right.
And that,
I don't really think it's for kids at all.
Well, but there are so many things about it that I think people would dismiss as being childish or, you know, not as sophisticated if they're not looking at it for real, if they're not actually reading it and taking it for what it is. I think I have heard people dismiss it before they have actually read it, and that kind of bums me out because they assume that it's just for kids.
Yeah. And I would tell people, you could read it with an older child. It's not for younger kids. And there's some heavy stuff that happens in here. It's not necessarily shown, but there's violence. It's just fun violence.
Right. But wasn't it a couple weeks ago when you said we need a new term for all ages? We obviously need to categorize it a little bit more strategically. But damn it, this is yet another perfect example of, for me, this is a great book for Avi, because there are conversations that we can have about the violence and, like, the concept of fun violence, which I'm just going to let slide. But it's important to the story, and it's so important to her character in the way that she handles that violence. I think that that's an important thing for a reader of any age to grasp, is how those moments can be a way of revealing something about a character visually that you can't necessarily do in words.
Yeah. Yeah, but you have to have a certain level of maturity in order to deal with these themes. I mean, it's just like sitting a 3-year-old down to play, you know, I don't know, Call of Duty or something like that. They have no way of differentiating that violence, you know, from any other references in their brain. They just don't have the capacity for it.
Right.
So it takes a little more sophistication to differentiate like humor and lightheartedness, and to see that subtlety of the sinister and the violent, you know.
Right.
That's a higher level of reading.
You're right. The context becomes even more important, and we've discovered that with Avi most recently, just because we're in the midst of this super media literacy campaign to convince him that like movies aren't terrible. And when he realizes that in order to appreciate a movie, he needs to have some context from like other movies that were made around the same time, or other stories that are referencing the same character types, or just like the entire concept of tropes, you can't, like, you have to learn all of that to appreciate how it all fits together. And so, like what you're saying, the sophistication of the approach to the violence and the humor and all of that in Bandette. And because she's she's a teenager as well, and the way that she interacts with the other kids is, there are a lot more layers there that you're right, you need some perspective on to like truly appreciate it.
Yeah, so I think that's important when you talk to people about books and recommending them for kids. What kind of kid is this appropriate for? Because this is appropriate for adults. I think adults all gravitate to this book, most do, because we can understand the subtlety of the story, which is why it's such an industry darling book too, because it captures that so well.
It's subtlety is a, I wish we had come up with that word earlier today, because that might be the key right there, is the subtlety is the difference between something that is written like truly to be appreciated between children and adults and something that is just written for kids. I don't like a lot of stuff that's just for kids, because contrary to popular belief, I'm actually not still just a kid. And the subtlety is the, like, I don't need to be hit over the head with stuff. I can read it. I like the levels, and the subtlety is great.
Having subtlety and nuance makes a book enjoyable for both parents and kids, because the kids might not get it. That's why something like, I don't know, for TV, like The Simpsons is great for everyone, because there's tons of stuff in The Simpsons that kids just don't get.
Mm-hmm.
But adults do, but kids just have, like, the main story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's what makes it really great, all, quote-unquote, all-ages type entertainment.
Plus, it's kind of awesome that, like, Bandette as a character has, like, basically her entire world wrapped around her little finger, and it's it's so charming.
But that can't go on forever. That gets boring after a while. Like, you know, that's got to change.
Sure. But we're only 5 issues into this. And so now it's established her power structure within the different types of people that she interacts with. Like, she's got her urchins who idolize her. And she's got Daniel, who also idolizes her, but in a different way. And the relationship that she has with the police. So even in the 4th issue, when she is like fighting with the, what is her name? The assassin that Finny sends after her. Right.
Mm-hmm.
there's such like lovely banter and like wordplay there, and she's never afraid. And yet when we see her, when she's not kind of costumed, she's got some like just a kid qualities to her still that are appealing. So I hope she doesn't lose that
innocence.
Well, absolutely. I hope she doesn't lose that innocence, but I don't want her to lose the bravado also, because I think that the juxtaposition of the two is actually kind of awesome.
But that is the evolution of people and characters. You know, that's what happens. It's even, to go back to like Rocket Girl, it's like, it's not interesting to see her be a 15-year-old forever. It's
right.
It's interesting to
suck.
Right. But what you learn is to actually be a more rounded person by experience.
Right.
So, you know, you might have Bandette be this bravado, you know, have all this bravado and rash, and she controls the world. And then you get older and you find out you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's part of growing up. So it's sad, that loss of innocence, but it's also part of maturity.
Makes for a good story.
That's right.
That's what we're here for.
Well, speaking of good stories,
are you
ready for our interview?
Such a great story. Such a great interview. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk to Howard Chaykin.
My name's Gracie Barnett, and my favorite comic book is Superior Spider-Man because of the twists, the cliffhangers, and the artwork. Stegman rocks.
Hello.
Hi, Howard. It's Aaron.
Hi, and one more time, I deeply appreciate your patience. I was listening to a rant from my attorney, and I owe him enough.
But this is okay now?
I am your bitch.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Yeah. All I ask you is don't make me look like a fucking moron.
I'm a very good editor. I'm pretty committed to making everybody sound smarter than they are.
That seems like a hell of a plan. I am your bitch.
Yeah, absolutely. This week on The Couch, we are more than pleased to welcome our guest, Howard Chaykin. A well-known artist and writer for the past 40 years, Howard is currently drawing Satellite Sam with writer Matt Fraction, writing and drawing Buck Rogers for Hermes Press, and I'm sure working on a pile of other projects. He's drawn and written...
One of those other projects is the Black Kiss Christmas special.
So you're just going to interrupt me at any point, right?
Was I not supposed to? I'm sorry.
We're trying to give you a lovely introduction here.
Go on. Pay no attention to old Jew, please. Go on.
He's drawn and written countless books for both Marvel and DC, but was also one of the first to publish commercially successful creator-owned work, which we're going to get to in a bit. And yes, Howard is known for his controversial and boundary-pushing series Black Kiss, published by Vortex Comics in 1988, and the follow-up sequel put out by Image Comics last year. We're going to talk about that, too. Thank you very much for making time to chat with us, Howard. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Please be on your best behavior.
Always.
Okay, well, I'm just going to jump into it. So you got your start in the comics industry with such people as like Gil Kane and Neil Adams.
And also Wallace Wood and Gray Morrow.
Right. So that goes to my question. Who were your biggest mentors when you first broke into the industry?
In order and sequence, Gil Kane, Neil Adams, Wallace Wood, and Gray Morrow.
Ah.
I worked for Gil as a gopher. Neil taught me how to do storyboards. I penciled for Wallace Wood and listened to him rant drunkenly.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to behave like a gentleman from Gray Morrow.
Yeah. You get the full rounded experience there.
Yes.
How'd that last one work out for you?
I actually am perceived as a gentleman in my real life. In my comic book life, I could give a shit.
That's fair.
So that being the case with such great mentors, is that over the years, have you taken on aspiring artists and helped them break into the industry? Like, have you become a mentor for people?
Absolutely. When my memorial comes around and I'm moldering, I'm guessing that I'll be spoken well of by a good dozen people.
An even dozen or a baker's dozen?
I'm willing to go out on a limb and go for the baker's. For me, it's a bagel's dozen. I have had an absolute, string of people working for me and with me, going back as far as the 1970s. And, those people would include everyone from Joe Jusko to Lynn Varley, Peter Cooper, Dean Hatfield, Larry O'Neill, Don Cameron, and more currently, Jed Dougherty, Ramon Torres, Calvin Nye. If I'm forgetting someone and I hurt a feeling, it's not really intentional, but we are never judged by our intentions, but by our actions. I learned a great deal about. I am everything that I learned from my mentors, and it is an apprenticeship program. And in my world, I feel that there's no way I can pay back the men that I learned from. So the job is to use that awful cliche, pay it forward. And continue the process. But I also learned a great deal about how to do that from those very men, because I was not the only one who was learned the craft at their knee.
So were you working with them, with other like up and coming artists, kind of simultaneously? So it was two levels of learning.
My work sucked until my late 20s, early 30s. I was a lazy, no account, nothing loser. And it really wasn't until I woodshedded in the late 1970s, early 1980s, doing something entirely different for a living, that I developed a respect for craft and a capacity to actually deliver work that wasn't embarrassing and shaming. And much of that evolved into what I did on Flag, And I did the first 12 issues of Flag all by my lonesome, which was incredibly physically destructive. It wrecked the shit out of me. And I learned, I spent the two-month hiatus I had on that book figuring out how to use an assistant. Now, I'd used an assistant on the graphic novels that I'd done with the currently dead Byron Prize.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't quite know how to apply what I learned from him, learned from doing those books. I didn't learn anything from Byron. believe me, you know, trust me. The only guy who made a living on Byron Prize's work was Byron Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to figure out how to apply an assistant's job to the work I did on Flag and the rest of the material. And once I did, I was able to do it consistently.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked with an assistant pretty steadily since the mid-1980s.
Does it matter if it's stuff for you, like creator-owned work, or do you use it?
I don't differentiate between creator-owned work and work for hire. There's no difference. I apply the same level of craft, the same level of effort, and the same commitment. Some years back I saw a rate card published by one of my colleagues that said something along the lines of really good job, okay job, who cares? And I thought that was appalling. And I'm sure he was being ironic, but I thought that was just absolute bullshit.
Hmm.
You sign on and you do the best job you can.
Sure, but I
think that, you know.
Do you have a preference?
For what?
I applaud the work commitment in terms of quality, but there's a difference, I think, in the enjoyment when you have complete control over working with a licensed property. So
I don't find that to be the case. I honestly don't.
Really. Fascinating.
No,
That's cool.
Feeling, I'm more interested in the form and the craft than I am in the content. Of course, when I write and draw my own stuff, I do have control of the content. But for the most part, the jazz that I get out of doing comics today is from doing them. It's the making. It's the craft work of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that craft work is applicable to both creator-owned material and work for hire.
Is it the process, not the product, then?
Yeah. You know, where were you when I was trying to put that thought together? That's exactly. That I couldn't put it better myself, and from now on I will steal that without any attribution.
Awesome.
Okay, I have a serious question for you. Have you ever been drunk with Harlan Ellison? And if so...
I have never met Harlan Ellison.
What?
Really?
That's mind-boggling.
And it's one of the great joys of my life.
You're going to share that now, then, right?
Harlan and I were neighbors. We live near each other. Harlan loathes and despises me because of his perspective. I ruined the shadow.
Wow.
And has taken and back in the 80s, he took it upon himself to attack me publicly in various venues. And he's met my second wife.
Is there a story there?
Back in the day at comic book conventions, when comic book conventions were actually for grown-ups as opposed to this laddie frat boy horse shit that has invaded the business,
mm-hmm.
we had a cocktail party on Saturday night. So we would all put on neckties and sport coats and suits, and our wives would wear dresses, and we would have cocktails and behave like grown-ups. that, of course, was replaced by these misanthropic, misogynistic little, you know, cigar-smoking, poker-playing shitbirds who go to strip clubs. But who am I to judge?
Right.
And Harlan actually approached my second wife, who was a sort of a big statuesque brunette, pressed his drink to her chest in that kind of subtle bar-y way. He may sue me for this, or I have to be very careful. and she said without a moment's beat, she said, "Oh, you're Harlan, aren't you?" And that was that. So no, we've never been introduced. We have mutual friends. The last time I saw him was in a Mongolian barbecue restaurant in Sherman Oaks when he was having dinner with Joe Straczynski, who was also a neighbor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe and I said hi, and Harlan didn't look at me, so that was okay.
Wow.
So I haven't had a drink in 22 years. So before that 22-year period, I never had a drink with Harlan, having never met him. And I can tell you right now, I had drinks with a lot of people.
We can probably cross this one off your list then. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
Why, Where in God's name and what nonsense factory created that question?
That was from a friend of mine. I promised I might ask him that, or ask you that.
And he remains anonymous because he's filled with shame and remorse?
Yes, yes. I fear for his life at this point, so I
really?
Will keep
Why?
Him. No, I'm kidding.
And maybe Harlan will sue him. Who knows?
Right. You know. I'll point the lawyers towards him.
Good call.
It's just really important that you understand that I had nothing to do with that question.
Do people like Harlan Ellison? Is he a lovable figure?
I don't think anybody would use the word lovable. I have a lot of respect for some of his work, but not necessarily for some of his behavior.
Okay. Well, that could apply to me as well, right? You know, I mean, I'm a...
Not so far.
I've often said that as long as John Byrne is still alive, I'll never be the most despised man in comics.
You just got to keep him healthy, then.
Well, yeah, that's almost an oxymoron right there, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. So, please go on.
sure.
Well, so you have a lot of experience throughout the years, and
that's
you
I'm
have...
fucking old. That's because I'm old. Experience comes with not dying.
Well, congratulations on that, not dying.
How very kind of you.
Thank you. So
I love being pressured. I mean, the only thing I hate more than being old is movies about cute fucking old people.
I don't find old people to be particularly cute.
That was a minor screed. That was a little screed that came out of nowhere. Sorry.
Okay. Do you still find yourself learning new things from the creators that you're working with now?
Absolutely. Unequivocally. I mean, I've often said publicly and privately that I am the least talented and least naturally skilled and gifted of my generation. And that in retrospect, as a boy, as a younger man, I resented handily being surrounded by incredible talents like Michael Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson and Walter Simonson. Mm-hmm. Until I realized my great gift was a desperate terror and fear of being identified as an imposter. So that I basically worked harder than anybody because I'm a fucking grind. And that what that's done is it has given me a career that's lasted for longer than 40 years. And it's taught me to continue to learn and remain green and be available for transformation and rebirth.
And at a certain point, I mean, you know, to go back to what you're talking about, you know, the early days, and at what point do you feel like you found your voice, you know, in writing and art? Was it with Flag? Was that like kind of that?
Absolutely. Unequivocally. I mean, Flag was a result of being solicited by First Comics to create a book. And I had been away from comics for a number of years. Hmm. And they offered me, I mean, I got working for Byron Price. The primary result of working for Byron Price was getting deeply into debt. Hmm. He paid nothing. And my part in that situation was allowing myself to be seduced into doing jobs that I really wanted to do. So basically, I can't blame him. It was a mutual self-destruction. At any rate, when First Comics came along and offered me an opportunity to earn enough dough that I could get out from under the debt that I had accrued working for Byron, and I really hated that. It's taken me years to figure out how to make a living and how to live like an adult. Mm-hmm. And much of that learning came after the Byron Price stuff. So can I
interject? Was that learning experience though over the years? Is there value in learning how not to get screwed? Right.
I don't think I got screwed by Byron. I think I colluded with eyes wide open. I don't think Byron was ethical. Is only the son of a lawyer to be ethical, and. Or unethical, depending on who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And so basically, I mean, I have no regrets. That's not my point. I did, however, after I stopped working for him, warn people away from working for him.
Mm-hmm.
For what that's worth. But doing Flag gave me an opportunity to get out from under that debt, but I also had an enormous amount of wiggle room and lead time. And that gave me an opportunity to apply what I'd learned from my woodshedding with doing all that paperback work and magazine illustration, to figuring out how to do a book that would be worth the time and energy. And bear in mind, it should be taken very seriously, the fact that Flag was not a seller on a par with the Marvel books or the DC books. It was a very successful independent comic book, mm-hmm. but it reached a very small, very, you know, not parochial audience. I mean, it met a very, very specific audience. And the result of that, to a profound extent, is that Flag is the comic book equivalent of the Miles Davis, Gil Evans, Birth of the Cool tapes.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with that material?
A little bit. Like, those are the, how to describe them? They're not the final studio recordings, right?
But these were, I mean, back in late 1949, Miles Davis and Gil Evans put together a group called the Nonet, which included Lee Konitz, Bill Barber, and a couple of other guys, who basically rehearsed. It was a rehearsal band. They're keeping the chops together. And they rehearsed in the basement of a Chinese laundry in the 50s on the East Side. And what they were, their goal was to try to achieve the sound and ambiance of a well-remembered orchestra of the 1930s and 40s called the Claude Thornhill Orchestra, with the fewest number of instruments as possible. Okay, and it was that was never commercially released until 1957, but the tapes had been circulated throughout the early 1950s, primarily through California. And it was that material that was the source material for the evolution and the birth of cool music, the cool sound of California, Shelly Mann, Woody Rogers, those guys.
Okay.
And to a profound extent, Flag plays that role because it didn't reach a huge part of the audience, but my colleagues all saw it, the comic book talent all saw it. So it became a textbook on how to apply the comic book technique in a new and different way.
Mm-hmm. And to break out of the DC Marvel kind of mold. Right?
And someone told me recently that I've not read the Marvel The Untold Story book, but apparently, according to the author of the book, I was supposed to do the book for Eclipse. This is absolute nonsense. Oh, not for Eclipse, for Epic, for the Marvel Epic.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Total nonsense. Not even a consideration. The only people I ever even proposed Flag to was first, after it was published. Jeanette Kahn told me that she felt that DC would have published it, and I disabused her of that as best I could because I felt that the reason that Flag was published in the form and content that it was that it was I was working for a company with no history and no baggage, that no preconceptions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absent those preconceptions, a book like Flag could come and behave in the way that it did. There's no way on earth that it could have been published anywhere else, and it was never ever considered for Epic.
Yeah, otherwise it would have been, you know, the only other stuff that even came close to it at the time was like zine culture or things that broke the mold, but they wouldn't have been seen even by anyone.
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
So basically Flag has provided has functioned as a textbook for a lot of talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only recently ditched the bitterness. You're laughing. I'm hoping that was a laugh of irony and recognition as opposed to dismissal.
No, not at all dismissal. Yeah, no, I could understand, especially at the time, like that, you know, what happened with those companies and the shift from just these two big monolithic kind of, you know, publishers for kids comics, essentially.
Well, I mean, for reasons which remain an absolute mystery to me, Todd McFarlane, who I've never met,
uh-huh.
Has identified me as an influence. And I just, what the fuck is that all about? I mean, I have absolutely no clue as to how he could perceive anything I've done as having an impact on his work, which I find shocking.
You don't think that there, at least, and this is going to come from a bit of ignorance, but at least image of the 90s was these creators breaking away from Marvel and DC to get away from that editorial stranglehold and be able to tell superhero stories that they wanted to.
Exactly the same bullshit Marvel and DC was doing.
Right. Well, so I think that was the failure of, and that was the collapse of the industry in the 90s too, wasn't it? That they had these grand ideas of separating.
I have no idea. I mean, I was working in television at the time, so I have very little idea what happened in comics in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Probably for the best.
And the very fact that all these guys took the power they had until they did their own version of the X-Men continues to stagger the living shit out of me. It's just, I mean, why? Well, I know why, because they're whores.
Yeah, but from that, you know, from that collapse, we have a industry now that has a lot of diversity, and people are telling stories that they never would have been able to in the 60s.
But I think that had less to do with image and more to do with the evolution of a self-referential Brooklyn hipster art culture, that was embarrassed by comic books would call it graphic novels.
Uh-huh. Hmm. Yeah.
I read Nikki Fling's blog every day, and at least once a day every day, there's somewhere B-list comedian has sold a pilot that's based on his own life, and I could give a shit about these people's lives. And that way about many comic books. I mean, that they're all this autobiographical shit, this narcissistic blogging crap drives me up the fucking wall. But who am I to judge?
Well, do you think that literature, whether it's comics or just, you know, written word, there's got to be some value in telling the real life story, quote unquote?
Oh, yes, but I also recognize the fact that most people just aren't that fucking interested.
Uh-huh. I think that's
absolutely.
You know, I mean, you look at the body of, I mean, Harvey Pekar is sort of, let's call it, the two guys who really created this form are Harvey Pekar and Chester Brown.
Uh-huh.
And Chester Brown is a cartoonist who drew his own stuff, and I'm in awe of Chester Brown's capacity for self-revelation and self-exposure. It's shattering to me. I'm incapable of that sort of awareness. Whereas Harvey's work, for me, without absent Robert Crumb, was excruciatingly interesting.
Mm-hmm. But it was the art that brought it to life.
That's how I see it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but that goes back to that interesting, when you get these interesting pairings of maybe Picard's, you know, day-to-day kind of what you would call maybe just a blog, you know, before the internet.
I want to know, if you're not bitter anymore, what are you now?
I'm not. By the way, you said that, and one of my colleagues just laughed at that I'm not bitter. I live in a state of acceptance to a profound extent. Mostly because it's been imposed on me. I did not get there out of free will. You know, I got there because I had other fucking options.
I accept that. That's fine.
You know, I mean, I have to remember that living well is the best revenge, as banal and cliche as that may be. You know,
yeah.
I realized that what I really wanted out of life was comfort and privacy. And that if I was going to take the praise of an audience seriously, it meant taking the blame too. And I wouldn't do that. So I recognize the fact that I live in a completely neutral position. And it's hard work. Because I have a conscious commitment not to read anything about me on the internet. It's usually the work of people who want my job, who hate me for whatever reason they do, and are too much pussy about it to sign their name to their work.
Mm-hmm.
And as my wife has pointed out to me more than once, I never listen to her. Why do I listen to these assholes? She's got a point. She's got a definite point.
Well,
I've weaned myself away from the interweb. Quite consciously.
Well, that's probably a good thing. I mean, if you get too wrapped up in what other what other people are dissecting about work or you personally, etc., I mean, that's got to dilute the kind of creativity too.
I don't know. My attitude is that most criticism in comics these days has become very much like criticism in film, which is more narrative and literary based as opposed to a holistic understanding of comics.
Yeah.
Very few writing comic book criticism have that holistic understanding. Do you guys read contemporary comics,
yeah,
outside of, you know, your mainstream and the weird shit as well?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I mean, you must be aware of the fact that certainly in the context of DC and Marvel, we are working and living in a writer driven business.
Yeah.
And I find that staggering, for any number of reasons. Marvel was always a writer's company, but DC had always been an artist's company. And that reality no longer plays. And what you've got is the criticism also approaches the material, and it ignores that, for my money, criticism should be about as much about the content, about the form and mechanics, as about the content.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I'm very much interested in the form and mechanics. I couldn't care less in most cases about the content. It doesn't interest me. Certainly in terms of mainstream material. It's execution. I mean, brands for me are not characters, but talent.
Well, so can we loop back then? This kind of leads me into a question. Can we talk about Black Kiss for a bit?
Oh, look, it's about me. I'm willing to mistake attention for affection, so of course.
Well, Black Kiss is a... I wasn't a contemporary, or I was, you know, I wasn't reading comics.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
Old are you? Okay.
So I came to Black Kiss from Black Kiss 2 last year.
Right.
And then I had to go back after the first issue, and I bought off eBay the first, you know, the first series. to read, because I read it and I'm like, what is this and what is the motivation behind it? And it really kind of led me on a research path. But
who the fuck does this guy think is buying this book?
Well,
I have no idea.
Well, I pick it up because honestly, it had your name on it. I wanted to read it, but I had no idea what the inside would be like, and I was totally ignorant of the past too.
Now, have you read the complete the second series?
Yes, yeah. So I read the first and the second series, and I think I have an understanding of the motivation maybe for the first series.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but was a response to kind of censorship and
yes. Absolutely.
So what about the second series then?
Well, I have been solicited to do a sequel to the book for 20 years.
Hmm.
Okay? And I had no clue what that would be. All right?
Yeah.
And and I like working in black and white. It's challenging, and it's a very different set of problems and issues. And getting back to what I said earlier, I'm interested in I like the process.
Yeah.
And I've told this story any number of times, so your people are going to be hearing this again. I had no idea what the sequel was until I was reading Stephen Sondheim's first collection of text about his lyrics. It's called Finishing the Hat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, may not be, I don't know if you're aware, but I'm a huge musical comedy queen.
Yes, that's fantastic. My background's in theater. Now we can be best friends.
When I was in New York 2 weeks ago, I saw Little Miss Sunshine, Pippin, and Big Fish.
Excellent.
And boy, Big Fish sucked.
Yeah, well, it's closing.
Oh, I know. I read that on Deadline on the New York Times. I called my wife, and she fell asleep during the first act. It was just awful. And I've already got tickets to see Bridges of Madison County, directed by Bart Scheer, and starring Stephen Pasquale and Kelly O'Hara, and Bullets Over Broadway, directed by Susan Stroman, with a new book by Woody Allen in March. And I saw Madeline in the original production in Matilda, rather, in London. So I'm reading Sondheim's book, and one of my wife's least favorite Sondheim shows is Follies. I love Follies.
Mm.
We saw a great production of it with Danny Burstein and Bernadette Peters not too long ago. And he's talking about I'm Still Here, the anthem that Carlotta sings at the end of the first act. You know the show, yes?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And I know the song. Yeah, and come on, I'm, like I said, musical comedy queen, you know. And in the text, he's talking about the fact that it's a fictionalized version of Joan Crawford's life and career. And the lights and the bells go off in my head. That's what it's about. And that's the sequel to Black Kiss.
Hmm.
Okay? It gave me an opportunity to illuminate some of this stuff and to also write about my love-hate relationship with popular culture media, specifically the movies and television.
Mm-hmm.
And bottom line is, I like drawing people fucking and shooting each other much than I like drawing guys in capes and masks beating this crap out of people.
I mean, ultimately, that's my question. Is a lot of it just an explore? It's just an allowance to kind of explore whatever dark fantasies you want.
Maybe, but yeah. I mean, right now I'm working on the third of five chapters for the Christmas special. Quite
yep.
Seriously.
Yeah. No, I pre-ordered it.
Each chapter is sort of a pastiche of one of my interests. The first chapter takes place in the couple of weeks after the collapse of the economy. In 1929,
mm-hmm.
And it makes references in a number of places to Thornton Wilder's Our Town,
mm.
In flashbacks. The second chapter takes place at a Klan rally, which goes right back to one of my favorite movies, Fury. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Third chapter takes place in a prison in 1940, it's in Leavenworth, and it's all about the big house and city, you know, and 20,000 years in Sing Sing and This Dawn I Die. I'm a product of spending a great deal of time in front of the television set in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth part takes place in a TV station in the early 1950s with a televangelist who's sort of a cross between Oral Roberts and Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. And the fifth is a Métis Santa Claus in 1962 in New York City. So it covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And again, I like doing period material, and it gives me an opportunity to write a fairly snarky text.
Yeah.
someone once dismissed my work many years ago as having public transportation dialogue, and I took that as an absolute beautiful measure of how I best felt about my work. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
I have a limited interest in most comic books as they're written, and whereas I don't much care about the work, I have a deep respect for Chris Claremont.
Hmm.
for having introduced an entirely new and different epic into the portrayal of superheroes. Stan Lee gets the credit. So, I mean, I don't think Chris gets enough credit for having sort of changed the way we think about the sort of characters he wrote about. And a lot of it is that he's his own worst enemy in many ways.
Well, yeah, but do you think that... I think he's gotten a lot more recognition now than he did in his time, too.
Oh, is that true?
I think so. I think that,
yeah,
like...
I agree.
Yeah, our generation...
So he must be really unbearable, I bet.
Well, it's kind of interesting. Like, he definitely has and probably rightfully so, a bitterness towards Marvel and his treatment, you know, and the recognition he got from that.
But I think that's true of so many of us. It doesn't really matter.
Well, yeah, especially if you look at the way the industry is now, and maybe I'm editorializing a little bit, but
you always do. It's fine.
Well, I mean, it's definitely changed, and I think there's an awareness of business sense with more of modern creators having learned the pitfalls of the industry from the previous generation, you know, Bronze Age creators, basically.
Bronze Age. You actually said that with your lips. That's fantastic.
No, oh, I'm one of those guys. But
He is. That's what I'm here for, to kind of temper those guys of Aaron.
So basically, I mean, I don't much care about, you know, about this material, but I do like the execution, you know, how it gets executed. That's what it's all about.
Do you read any contemporary comics?
I read Scalped for its run. I thought it was a really terrific book, and it took me a very long time to get past the artwork because I was not a fan of the artwork to begin with. I felt the book was oddly and miserably colored. I think the coloring distracted from difficult to read artwork as it was. I occasionally read Kurt Busiek's Astro City because there's something kind of weirdly meta about it, and Kurt is another musical comedy queen in the comic book business. So
yeah,
I feel like I owe him a touch, you know. And that's about it. I can't think of anything else. I mean, I read Alan Moore stuff when he comes out, just because Alan can be so entertaining and exasperating. I mean, I was a huge fan of Tom Strong, and I hated Prometheus. I love Jim Williams stuff. I love Jim personally. I love his work. I just hated it. It was just I felt it was the worst kind of New Age English art fag mumbo jumbo bullshit. I love Top Ten. And League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, except for the later ones, really knocked the shit out of me. I thought it was really swell.
So what about Watchmen then?
I read Watchmen before you did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because when I was getting it in black and white while I was working on that first Shadow series.
Yeah.
I've always believed that in a just and real universe, Watchmen would have put an end to superhero comic books. Because it peeled back the curtain to reveal just how schmucky they were, and instead it created an entire new lexicon and dialect for lesser talents to pursue. I also feel that Watchmen is exactly like every other thing that Alan has done, which is that he hasn't never been able to write an ending. And that for all the shit that Zack Snyder took for the movie, he constructed an ending that was internal to the material, making the problem that Ozymandias was going to solve, John, really made a great deal more sense than stealing an episode of Outer Limits for the ending of Watchmen. Only crazy.
No.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Did you read comics when you were a kid?
Oh man. I weighed 265 pounds when I was 17. And I, although I'm figuring I'll get there when I die. At any rate, when I was 4 years old, I was given a refrigerator box filled with comic books by two cousins of mine who felt they'd outgrown them. One was 9 and the other was 7.
Oh, that's so sad.
And to this day, I can still recall the smell of that box.
Aww.
Mildewed paper. And I have loved comics. And at that point, that day, I decided this is what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I have loved comic books ever since, passionately and occasionally unconditionally.
So even in the times where you were working in other industries, did you always keep up with the comics industry or comics in general?
I did not keep up, but I didn't burn bridges either.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when I lost my last job in 2002 in television, I never worked on a show I'd watch, so it didn't really matter to me. And I was very grateful to have the money. because the reason I moved to Southern California was when I realized that I was never going to be a star in the comic book business. I have my work is too strange and too odd, and I'm not, and I don't really care about the feelings and sensibilities of the audience. They generally speaking, their opinions are secondhand and, you know, and once removed from actual thought. You know, we live in a culture that is, you know, incredibly opinionated and astonishingly uninformed. And I realized I had to make some dough because I planned to get this fucking old. And I
not old, experienced.
I'm sorry, your lips, God's ear, bud. God, I have no belief in my life. But at any rate, I came out with a desperate attempt to get into movies. Ended up in television. I was very lucky. I worked with people I really liked for the first half, and I worked with people that I would easily see with their heads fucking exploding for the second half. And but I got out, and I'm very grateful. But I was able to return to a comic book career without any real hesitation once I convinced them that I wasn't really kidding when I said I never wanted to do television again. Most people in comic books would kill to have a TV career, and I was grateful to have mine. But when it was over, and I was done.
Hmm.
And I didn't really read comics. I mean, when I look at comics today, what I'm looking at about them is for an abstraction. That said, there are certain writers that I absolutely love to work with.
Mm-hmm.
As I write my own stuff, I draw other people's stuff, and I write for other people. And when I'm working with other writers, there are writers who I just adore working with. I love working with Matt Fraction. I love working with Mark Guggenheim. I had a great time working with Jason Aaron. It was just a terrific talent.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular reason why?
Well, in Guggenheim's case, because Mark and I have a simpatico of visual style that I can identify a Mark Guggenheim script from across a room by another artist. I know Mark calls out shots. Mark's calling out of shots isn't like mine, but it is so easily identifiable by me that his work is, there's no decoding involved. Matt's work requires a greater decoding. Matt is also a product of Mark is, I think Matt is 10 years Mark's junior, I think, in that regard. So he comes out of that decompression shit.
Mm-hmm.
When I work with Matt, there's much more encoded work in the material. Guggenheim is someone I love working with. I mean, I did a freebie for the anti-bullying comic book, specifically with the assumption that I will not work with anybody but Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's great.
That's sort of where that's at. Aaron's is challenging, but less so than Matt. I appreciate the challenge from Matt because, you know, Matt is, you know, we are twin sons of different mothers. I really adore Matt Fraction. And I'm quite serious. I mean, we very much have a great deal of simpatico. I'm crazy about him. I'm crazy about his wife. His kids are great.
He speaks very highly of you on the internet, but you probably miss it since you don't play on the internet.
I know that he had a Twitter account. Things My Chaikin Says.
Yes.
Yeah, Things My Howard Says. Yeah.
Because when I talk to him, I say these absolutely horrible things.
Yeah, it's pretty. Well, funny
I mean, you should understand. I'm not a nice person. I'm a good person.
No.
I'm kind of mean and shitty in a lot of ways. and I'm okay with that. I don't really give a fuck. But I love Matt. And so basically, I just read the script for Satellite Sam 6 yesterday. And it's a raging fucking pain in the ass. but it will be a great job because it'll push me in directions that clearly my lazy fat ass doesn't want to go to. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, it seems like the scripts for...
Hold on just a moment.
Sure.
That's the police calling. Hold on just a moment. Okay. Sorry about that. That was me being strict with one of my assistants.
That's fine.
Oh.
Understandable.
You got to be strict.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because you're mean.
What do you mean strict? Get the fuck out of bed. You know, that kind of shit.
So the scripts for Satellite Sam, I can just reading that first issue especially, I can imagine the complexity.
Yes.
In drawing it, and it seems it's got to be pushing the creative the creative juices basically. It's got because it's such a different way of drawing comics than I think I've seen from you in the past.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, there are a lot of tropes that he's using. There's stuff that I've used.
Sure. Yeah, but in execution, is it quite different than what you're used to?
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of the Dark Knight Returns kind of, you know, broke everything breaks down into a tiny panel.
Uh huh.
You know, one of my issues with the current affairs of comic books is that to a profound extent there are too many panels on the page, which leave little or no room for the narrative effect of graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
That I believe is a linchpin. I mean, I spent the weekend at a writers conference, a crime writers conference. I was invited as sort of the field hand. And it was a very intriguing and odd experience because the younger talent knew who I was, but most of the older ones couldn't really give a shit, you know. And I read a lot of crime fiction, but a lot of these are like, you know, private detectives and shit like this.
Uh-huh.
And there are people who just think my wife has been hawking me to write a novel for years, and I keep trying to explain to her that I can't afford to. I'm making too much money doing comics, and I can't.
No one has ever said that before.
Well, I mean, my expectations of comics are very low. I do okay. I mean, I have no complaints. I work my ass off. But you know, I tend to, like everybody who's a lazy ass motherfucker, I tend to rely on tropes. And one of the things that Matt has done is he's brought back a lot of the stuff that comes back from me. One of the things I have to keep pushing him on is leaving me enough room to design pictures that have narrative content. Because many, I mean, look, I wrote a document for Marvel about a year or so ago, which I believe, for example, there are three basic streams of storytelling in the comic book business. There's Harvey Kurtzman, there's Will Eisner, which is journalism, there's Will Eisner, which is melodrama, and there's Kirby Lee, which is impact, mm-hmm. not action. And I've come to believe that the current writing pool is trying to achieve Kirby Lee effect with Eisner technique.
Hmm.
And I believe that that's counterintuitive. Okay?
Yeah. But there's still a blur. There is room for blurred lines between those, right?
I agree. But you can't achieve the kind of impact that Stan and Jack were achieving with four panel pages in 7 or 8 or 9.
Yeah.
Right.
If I see one more script from a writer telling me big panel, and on a page of 7 other panels, I'm gonna vomit.
Uh-huh.
That's called not rereading what you've just written.
Right.
All right.
Like the if the pacing is fucked, then everything else about the story is impeded.
I believe that you have to leave room to create visuals that have narrative content.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you end up with postage stamps, which is what I believe a great deal of Dark Knight was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But some people revere that style too. It's so interesting.
Yeah, it's a writer's style. It's not a visual narrative style.
Yeah. And I think there's so much of a tendency to lose that showing and the telling, you know, takes over, that people don't allow for the artist to kind of show what's happening. They're relying on the narrative itself.
I mean, bear in mind that Kurtzman did 8 panel pages, but he also had a sense of rhythm that was transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a word counter, you know. Each one of his captions and balloons was specifically designed to have the number of pictures and the number of words in it and to support the shape.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, he was a guy who understood that even narrative, that text had graphic value. One of the reasons I'm happy it's working with Ken Brusenak is he also understands that.
Is that something that you have found that some writers find intuitively, or does that come with experience and time?
I don't find most writers having that understanding at any point. I think you have to be a cartoonist to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Call me crazy.
No, I agree. I think that it's a method of communication that is inherently visual, and yet there are many people working in the medium who aren't very good at the visual. So I completely agree that if you don't have that, it's a very difficult thing to learn the visual impact of the words on the page, you know, graphically in and of themselves.
I mean, significantly, let us not forget that from a printer's perspective, what we call the appearance of text on a page is color.
Right. and negative and space. Yeah.
It's not an accident. It really isn't. Didn't expect this stuff, did you?
No, it's exactly why we wanted to talk to you, because you're old. I mean, experienced.
Nice. Wow. And here I thought I was your bitch.
Aww.
Oh, wait a minute. Hey, wait. Why, Iota? Okay.
Well, see, I'm the one who gets to edit, so just keep that in mind.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
This is why I keep her around.
I guess I've been put in my place, but officially.
Do you have any last words of wisdom, or, you know, do you want to tell somebody specifically to fuck off?
Anybody I know?
The platform is yours.
I'm learning restraint of tongue and pen. I'm serious. I was telling a pal of mine yesterday that I was in the Chicago airport on Monday flying home from Milwaukee, and I crossed over someone's path unintentionally, and he followed me into the Admiral's Club to complain that I'd spilled his coffee on his hand. And
wow.
And this is not some 20-something with a pork pie hat who believed that his parents, you know, owed him a living. He was my age. And my first instinct was to say, holy fuck, I missed a memo that required me to pay attention to your fucking life today. I'm awfully sorry. And then turned away from him because I was ready to go right back and say, but go fuck yourself. And I didn't. So I'm flattering myself now by having restrained tongue and pen. So I'm gonna stick with the flattery.
Yeah.
So, but can I ask you, was there a point in your life when you would have actually done that?
Told him to go fuck himself?
Yeah.
A couple of weeks back.
Okay.
So this is a recent maturity.
Oh, no, I mean it's got warp and weft. It waxes and wanes. I mean I'm inconsistent in my character. There's a wonderful novel by Terry Southern called The Magic Christian, a dreadful movie, but a terrific novel. At one point, the title of the novel refers to a sailing ship, and he's going to do a cruise, and it's an invitation only cruise, and people are writing for invitations, and he receives a request for an invitation from an Italian countess, and purely on the spur of the moment, he writes back with a scrawled crayon, "You kidding? No fucking wops." And to a certain extent, I said, I'm like that, and I should learn not to. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Sebastian and I has a couple of words for us. What? You're naked again. How'd you manage that? The timing thing. Want to do this, Ray? Is an anesthetic? We're gonna set it for 25. How many minutes? 30 minutes?
30.
For 30?
Yeah.
Hey, you want to listen? Hold on. You have me back.
Okay.
What does he have to do for 30 minutes?
I have no idea. But he's naked and he had a timer in his hand, so basically I'm willing to work with him. I have 6 grandchildren.
Ah.
Excellent.
13, 10, 9, 6, 4, and 2.
My son is 8, so I feel like the best is yet to come.
I'm the weird Uncle Carl of grandparents, you know, and I'm... really happy because I mean, they've got a grandfather who makes his living drawing comics, who does not countenance nonsense, but is perfectly willing to walk around with his underwear on his head to get as cheap a laugh as I can out of a 3-year-old. What more can you ask?
That's perfect.
I have no dignity whatsoever except when I choose.
All the qualifications you need for being a good grandfather.
I think so too.
I'm the fucking best, man.
Yeah, you are.
My grandparents came out of the shtetl. They were ghetto dwellers. They were little old Jews. You know, looked like kitchen. My grandfather looked like he was going to play Lincoln in a Polish production. And my grandmother was a kitchen witch. And you know, she had no teeth, and she took great delight in showing me the fact that she had no teeth on a regular basis. Which I was really grateful for because it was comedy gold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My goal in life is to be as charming, entertaining, and educational, and strict with my grandchildren as possible. It's a gas. I love it. My daughter will frequently send my eldest grandchild over when she's screwing around in school for the shape up.
Mm-hmm.
She had to read Animal Farm over the summer, so I downloaded a college level quiz because I'm a complete asshole.
It's good. Keeps them in line too.
Absolutely. This shit you're gonna be using this later on in life when your kids get to be old enough and they really hate you.
No, I'm writing this down. This is this is good advice.
I don't know. We had Avi and I had a big knockdown dragout battle about his homework this morning. So I feel like I'm right in the middle of it, even though it shouldn't be coming for a couple of years. But third grade is hard.
he's about 4 years away from truly hating you. And he's writing all this shit down to get back. This is all the shit, the sharp knife shit therapy. It's working.
Right, right.
Where are you guys?
I'm in San. We're right outside of San Francisco. And
oh, okay. So you're West Coast, Ian. All right.
And Aaron's in Oregon.
What town are you in?
I'm in Eugene.
Oh, really? I have dear friends up there.
Yeah, no, it's a great town, and we're just, you know, right below Portland too, which is a great city.
Oh, I know. I'm very, very close friends with Ben Saunders. Who teaches comics at U of O.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah.
And where are you, Andrea?
I'm in San Mateo, about 20 minutes south of San Francisco.
I know San Mateo very well.
Yeah.
My third kids they live in Walnut Creek.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I'm in Ventura, which is, you know, a half hour south of Santa Barbara. I'm very flattered. Your attention has been fabulous, and
you're great. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and again I patience with
work. Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you
again. Warm and dry, and we'll talk.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
So we just want to say thank you to Howard for that wonderful interview. We're really honored that he took the time to speak with us today. For everyone else, as always, we want to remind you that you need to pre-order your comics at your local comic store or even digitally, because comics pre-orders mean success or failure for so many books. Thanks again for everyone for listening. Thanks so much to Howard for being part of our show and taking the time to talk to us. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And we'll talk to you next week. Everything is on the website, comicstherapy.com. Talk to you later.
Don't forget to register for the first annual Comics Therapy Secret Menorah. Deadline is next Friday.
Blech. Okay, who are you?
Luke Tiberius Myers.
And who is your favorite superhero?
Batman.
Why?
Because I think he's cool.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Wonder Woman.
You like Wonder Woman
too? Yeah.
Okay.
And Batman and Superman and you.
Thank you.
And that's all I want to say, because that's a lot of superheroes.
That sure is. Do you want to say goodbye?
Bye. Who are we talking to?